Okay, I ended up kind of putting out just a rough outline for what we're trying to do. I've got chapters 7 through 12. I also realize that as we're kind of going through this verse by verse, I've got a lot of you that I'm kind of losing in the process, because it's not like Hosea is that exciting. You know, it's not like the minor prophets. To me, it's all very interesting. I get wrapped up in all the little nuances that are going on, but in reality, what you have is you have God repeating and giving the case again and again and again against Israel. Against Israel, against the northern 10 tribes. And when we look at Hosea, it's kind of like looking at Isaiah or looking at Jeremiah. To us, it's all one book. All put together as one book. And so we read it in the context that it was all stated at one time. Sometimes we do that. I think there's a lot of us. I know I do it, but I know from other people that they do the same thing. That they don't think about the fact that these prophecies were actually given over a length of time. It's like reading the book of Acts. We all understand, because Acts is an historical narrative, that the book of Acts didn't all take place at once. But it's the same thing is true of the prophets that are in the Old Testament. Isaiah prophesied over the course of, 70 years? And it's one of the reasons that liberals said, Isaiah could not possibly have written all of the book of Isaiah. There had to be at least two Isaiahs that wrote that, for the very fact that nobody prophesied for 70 years. God could make a guy prophesy for 70 years if he wanted to. He could give him hell. I was going over, because of some statements that are made here in the context of this, I was going back over mortality statistics. At the time that the Old Testament was in existence, the average age, the average lifespan was 30 years. Do you understand what that means? The majority of people did not live past 30 years. That would put all of us in the extra long live situation. I mean, how'd you like that? But now's the case. And if you stop and think about that, that this is one of the reasons that they couldn't live that long. But in reality, they did. Some of these people did live long. Hosea, you remember from last week, we talked about this. How long is Hosea how long did he prophesy? About 30 years. So when you're reading the book of Hosea, you're reading a set of prophecies that he gave over the course of 30 years. We all pack it in and we just cram it, one right after the other, one right after the other. And sometimes we scratch our heads and go, didn't he just say that? Didn't he just say that? Didn't he just say that? It really does. Which is the key thing that goes on in the book of Hosea. That in Hosea, he is trying to... you don't have to leave. Are you done upstairs? Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. is that in the... get my train of thought back here. Is that in the context of what's going on in the book of Hosea, that he repeats these things again and again because he's giving the picture of a marriage, God's marriage to Israel, pictured by Hosea's marriage to Gomer. And he's showing that he's long-suffering. He's showing that he is giving them the opportunity before they go into captivity in 722 BC, that he is giving them the opportunity to turn around and come back. Okay? Now, let me draw a comparison here. It's not absolutely, this isn't a perfect comparison by any means, but let me draw a comparison. There is, John tells us in 1 John chapter 5, he says that if you have a brother that is not sinning the sin unto death, that you can talk to God, you can ask, and God will forgive him. Okay? He does say in there, however, that there is a sin unto death. Concerning this, he says, I say that you should not ask about this. So there is a sin unto death. We know that because when Paul writes 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he talks about the fact that there were people that had been chastened to the point that they died. Now, here's a question for you. Normally, Does a Christian get out of line? Does God step right in and whammy? That's it. No. I think there is a chastening process that leads to that. Okay. In other words, God deals with discipline with those people leading up to that normally. No. Are there exceptions to that rule? I'd say Ananias and Sapphira are an exception. Were they given an opportunity to change their mind? I think probably when they stood before those people, they probably could have said, no, we did it wrong, we're sorry. But really, they weren't given a, shall we say, a long-term scenario in which they could change. Okay. But most of the time, the progression that you had in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, I think, is true. For this cause, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. So it starts with this weakness, this asthenia. It starts and then it goes on to a more severe sickness, eventually leading to ultimately death. And that's the way God, and I think that's normally the way God works. Now, obviously, we're talking about living in the dispensation of grace, which is not absolutely identical to what God is doing under the law. But there are comparisons, because he is the same God. He's the God that tells us. We read the law, and you and I just think, man. In fact, I've been doing a lot of work, reading a lot of church history with regard to doctrine. And it's amazing. Now, one of the earliest problems that the church dealt with in the second century, less than 100 years after the New Testament was finished, were people that said the God of the Old Testament cannot be the God of the New Testament. We've got to be talking about two separate gods. Because the God of the New Testament is a nice guy. God of the Old Testament is mean and grouchy, and he kills people and slaughters. He's vengeful and wrathful. Some saying, number one, they haven't read their Old Testament well enough if that's all they see. And they also haven't read their New Testament enough if all they think is the New Testament God is made. There's a balance in God's character. And the God of the law that gave Moses the law is also the God that tells us that he is big, broad, rabbi, in loving kindness. That's God. He's big when it comes to being faithfully, lovingly kind. And so if you keep that in mind, that God is our God, and that's the God that Hosea is being directed to prophesy to the nation of Israel about their problems, about their, and he uses this in here, their adultery or their prostitution because they pursued other gods. So, let's start up here at the top. We're going to put in Hosea 7 tonight. Hosea chapter 7. There's going to be a number of comparisons that he's going to go through. Okay? He is going to compare Israel to, one of the first things he's going to do is he's going to talk about them being a hot oven. And as a result of being a hot oven, what happens if you have an overly hot oven? And you and I don't, when we think of a hot oven, we think of this thing. Their hot oven, remember, is probably something made of brick or clay, and they stoke it full of fire. And what they're doing in an oven is they're baking, not meat. They didn't bake cooked meat in ovens like we do. They roasted those over open fires. They use these for baking breads and cakes, and not cakes like we think of cake. Okay. And so, as a result, they're an unturned cake. A cake that you threw in there on the hot stone, and you don't flip it, you don't turn it. What eventually happens to it? It burns. It's no good. Nobody wants to eat that. Nobody likes to eat. It's like when you make your toast, and then you forget about it. And then you go put it back down in the toaster for a second time, and now it comes out and it's black. You don't want to eat it. If you're like me, you scrape all the black stuff off because you hate to waste a slice of bread, but at the same time, it burns you that you're eating burned toast. Okay? Then they're like a silly dove that's flown off to all these other people, and God's going to take them in a net. Okay? And then, and lastly, they're a deceitful or a neglected bow, which we'll talk about when we get there, and as a result, they're going to. This is an L. They're going to fall. They're going to fall by the sword when they go to war. So if we can get through those, then we'll move on. We'll see what time it is. So we just kind of keep track. I'd like to get through all of these tonight, but I think I know myself a little bit better than that. So Hosea chapter 7. Hosea chapter 7. And we put in and it says, when I would heal Israel, that is when he was in a situation where this is what he would do, this is how he would respond to them. The iniquity or the perversity of Ephraim is uncovered, the evil deeds of Samaria, for they deal falsely. The thief enters in, bandits raid on the outside. You do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them. They are before my face. Simple point that we can say, in fact, there, you know, there's that Old Testament statement about that where they had some tests under the law for what people had done, different things, and they had a verse, your sins shall find you out. Well, it's God simply saying, you can't hide your sins from me. I see everything that you do, and I don't forget any of it. You know? These people thought God would forget this stuff. He'd just let it go, let these things go in there. Now, if these people were really seeking forgiveness, the God, in terms of his forgiveness, he separates the sins as far from us as far as the east is from the west. But that's for people that have sought forgiveness. That's for people that have actually acknowledged their wrongdoing. These are people that are looking, oh, God's not going to do anything about this. God's not going to mess with this. God will forget this. Oh, he'll forget it. And that's the way they're responding to this. So it says in verse 3, with their wickedness, they make the king glad, and the princes with their lies. They are all adulterers, like an oven heated by the baker who ceases to stir the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. So he's looking at them as he's using the idea of they're hot as adulterers. That just keeps getting hotter and hotter. Then he's going to go on and he says, on the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. So now he's going to look at heat in terms of the heat that you get when you drink something alcoholic like this. And you get that heat that builds up in here. He says, he stretched out his hand with scoffers. So first of all, it's the heat of adultery. Second of all, it's the heat of wine. Then he goes, for their hearts are like an oven as they approach their plotting. Their anger smolders all night. In the morning, it burns like a flaming fire. So he's looking at the way that they plot things, the way they think, and they get this. You know what that's like when you're planning something and you kind of start getting excited about what you're planning and it works up inside you and it's almost like you get so wound up that it creates heat. That's what he's talking about in here. But he looks at it as also the fact that they're plotting to do things and the anger starts to overwhelm them. And if you've ever been mad about something and you start to think about how you're going to make it right, how you're going to justify yourself, how you're going to get even, whatever, something to that sense. And the more you think about it and the more you plot, the hotter you get. So we got the heat of adultery, the heat of wine, the heat of a plotting anger, plotting angry mind, and then verse 7, all of them are hot like an oven, and they consume their rulers. All the kings have fallen. None of them calls on me. So he's looking at all this context that it's even to the point that they turn on their very rulers in this process. And so he says, Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. In other words, he's looking to the nations as a source of help, trying to get them to figure out their problems. And Ephraim then has become a cake not turned. Now I know a lot of your Bibles, like the New American Standard, they break the text between verses 7 and 8. But 8 goes along with the verses about the heat and how it affects them as a cake that's not turned as they have run to all these other nations. In other words, they thought other nations can solve their problems. Who's going to solve their problems? God's going to solve their problems. But rather than turning to God to solve their problems, they turn and run off to all these other nations in the process trying to do this. Then we come to the next statement, which the next metaphor that he's going to use with regard to them. First we have the hot ovens and the cake not turned. Then he says, we have to finish up verse 9. Strangers devour his strength, yet he does not know it. Gray hairs are sprinkled on him, yet he does not know it. Now, this is pivoting. Now, this is the verse that joins the two metaphors. We've had the cake unturned as they've run to other nations. But as they run to other nations, they don't realize every time they've turned to somebody other than God for help, they're giving something up. I think it's a good lesson for you to learn. Every time you turn to the world to solve your problems, which is essentially what they're doing, rather than turning to God, you are weakening yourself. You're taking your, you are giving things up blow by blow, little by little, and you don't even realize it. Most Christians do not become worldly by taking a dive off the high dive into the deep end. They wade in a little bit at a time. And so, he's talking about here that he does not even know it. He's not even aware that he's losing his strength to these people as he turns to them. Verse 10, though the pride of Israel testifies against him, yet they have neither returned to the Lord their God, nor have they sought him for it. So they've lost the very thing that they should have made them proud, which is their prosperity. Remember in this context, this letter, he says it was their prosperity made them proud because God gave them prosperity, and they looked at their prosperity and said, we did this. We did this, and we got it from Baal. Well, now it's gone. God's taking their prosperity away. Now, this is one of the things that's happening over the course of these 30 years of Hosea's prophecy, is that God is taking away their benefits, taking away their prosperity. And as he takes that away, they fail to realize, they fail to come to grips with the fact that as it goes, they should go back to God. But they don't go back to God. So verse 11, so Ephraim has become like a silly dove. Silly, the American standard there, is a word meaning simple-minded. Simple-minded dove that has no sense. They called Egypt, and they go to Assyria. In other words, why would you go to these two people? God had delivered them out of Egypt, so why would you return and go back to that nation? They're turning to Assyria up to the north, which, if they paid any attention to Assyria, they'd see Assyria was a nation that was taking up everybody around them as much as they could. As if you don't think that you're not on the list, we just haven't got to you yet, but we'll get there eventually. Same. And yet they're turning to these other people like a silly-minded dove. And I don't know if there's something in the nature of a dove that when you think about that, when I think of the doves around here, you think of animals that are easily scared and they bolt. You ever notice that? I've never hunted dove. Ben were here, we could ask him, but one of the things Ben likes about the sport of hunting dove is they're a bird that when you flush them, they flush so fast. You've got to be right on them, from what I understand. And I can believe that because we have them in the trees out front here and in the parking lot and stuff. And when you come up and you start those things, boom, they just come out like that.
But usually it's coming out 25, so you shoot at one, you might get the other one.
And so he says that in verse 12. Now we hunt them, as Gary is talking about, or as Ben would do, we hunt them with shotgun. You know, so you're putting out, you're scattering some shot out there and hoping that a bit of shot catches one of them. Or two of them, as Gary pointed out. But verse 12 goes on, this is the way they hunted birds. When they go, I will spread my net over them, and I will bring them down like the birds of the sky, and I will chastise them in accordance with the proclamation to their assembly. So he looks at it as a fowler that has a net that you get these birds and as you startle them so that they come up and you throw, and the net pops up and they fly into the net and get stuck in the net. Okay? Peg and I don't know if Peg remembers this, but actually I don't know if you were there for this, but when we were in college, there was a guy from our church that was a biologist working for the state biology department, and they were catching hawks and banding them for the state. Down on, I can't remember what the river was down there where we were at the campground. And that's what for them, they used a rabbit. You don't bait doves with rabbits, but they put a rabbit down. They're a real rabbit out on a rope. You don't bait doves with a rabbit. But they did, and those things, and when those hawks, when they see a hawk fly over, they pull on the rope out there, and the rabbit would kind of start to jump around, but it couldn't get loose, and that hawk just would zero in, and when it would get down there, then they had this spring-loaded, and this net would come over the bird, and they'd catch it just like that. Well, that's the way these people hunted, and God said, that's the way I'm going to take you. I'm going to throw a net over you. I'm going to catch you. You're not going to get away. You think you're a silly dove flying off to all these people, but I'm going to catch you in my net. He says, verse 13, then woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction is theirs, for they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. And by redeem, you understand, this isn't talking about the redemption as we think of it now. This is the redemption in the sense of to deliver, to rescue. I would rescue them from all of this. And I've told you this before. I've gone over the Hebrew word redeemed throughout the Old Testament, and with the exception of about maybe two or three passages, I haven't found any that I think really conclusively refer to spiritual redemption as we understand it in what we've been looking at on Sunday mornings. It's all always it's a redemption that. Yeah, and so that's a physical. So it's a physical redemption. In other words, physically he got to live. What happened if you didn't? It's implied, although not indicated. What happened if you didn't redeem the firstborn mule or the firstborn calf? You were supposed to break its neck. You had to kill the animal if you didn't redeem it. What's it implied you were supposed to do if you didn't redeem your child? The child should be killed. So you redeemed it, so you didn't kill the child. Because God didn't want him to kill the child. He wanted them to redeem the child. In other words, to allow it to live. Yeah. And stop. And again, stop and think about the redemption of then a firstborn. What did that hearken back to? What God did to deliver Israel from Egypt. By rescuing the firstborn in Egypt. He didn't save the firstborn spiritually. He physically redeemed it so that they lived and didn't die by them putting that up. And so from that point on, then, they were always going to do this as a memorial to remember that the firstborn were the rescued ones. And so they're rescuing their firstborn. So he's talking about this redemption. I would redeem them, but they speak lies about me. Now, I think when they speak lies about him, they're probably misattributing what he does to Baal. That's one of the ways in which we know, as we've gone through this, that they lie. The other way in which they lied about God was at times they even called Baal Jehovah. They made the, remember, as we were talking about, the syncretism or the inclusivism, syncretism really, where they just melded the two religions and didn't make any difference in this. And so he goes on from there, verse 14, and they do not cry to me from their heart when they wail on their beds for the sake of grain and new wine. They assemble themselves. They turn away from me. In other words, when they cry out, when they act as though they're praying to me, wailing because they don't have grain, wailing because they don't have new wine, because they've lost all their prosperity, they're not really crying to me from their heart. They're just crying to me because their stomachs hurt. That's all he's saying. They just want to eat. But they're not really crying out to me. They haven't changed within their heart, within their decision-making center, is what he's getting at. Verse 15, although I trained and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. I'm the very one that gave them their ability. Verse 16, they turn, but not upward. They are like, now, third metaphor that he uses of them, they are like a, now the New American Standard says, a deceitful bow. Now, that word that's translated deceitful is a word meaning neglected, is one of the ways that the word is used. Let me turn my page. Neglected or a worthless bow. In other words, it's deceitful because you've got a bow on the wall. It looks like it's good. Now, how many of you have ever used a bow? Shot. Okay. If you have... not like the big fancy compound bows that they use, but a standard traditional bow that they've used. What's one of the things you do when you store it?
You take the string off.
You unstring it, okay? You keep it unstrung so it maintains tautness so that when you put it back between your legs, tie it around, pull that string up over there, you know that that bow's got some strength. This word that's being used here for a neglected bow is a bow that has been sitting on the shelf, probably, though not necessarily, probably left strung so that when you go and you fit an arrow to it and you go to fight in war, it doesn't have the ability to throw an arrow far enough anymore. It's lost its strength. And it looks like it's a fine bow until you go to use it and you find out it's no good. Okay? It's kind of like some of you kind of know what it's like to have a firearm that is neglected, and what's one of the things that goes out in a firearm that's neglected, left and sat too long? The firing pin doesn't want to work. And you go and you load the thing up and you cock it and you pull it back and it can't knock the firing pin in there so it doesn't hit the shell. gun might look nice, but it's neglected, and you can try and shoot it all day you want. You're going to have to get some, what is that? I can't think of the stuff you put in there that hopefully will free up the firing pin. I can't think of the name of that. What? Well, something like that. Penetrating oil. Some sort of a penetrating oil you put in there or something to try to free up. I've got some stuff. I had to free up a mechanism on one of my rifles because it wasn't working very well. But that's the case here. They have a deceitful bow. And so as a result, their princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. They will be a derision in the land of Egypt. In other words, the very place where they came out of, they're going to go, yeah, they fell. Did you hear about it? They fell in war. Because they go out there to fight. Oh, we got our bow. Pull the bow down. The bow doesn't work. I can't throw an arrow far enough to fight those guys off. And so those guys come up and they charge them with the sword and they fall by the sword. Okay. So he looks at them, compares them to three things in this. They're hot, so they're like a cake unturned. Okay, number one. Number two, they're like a silly dove, so God takes them in the nap. And number three, they're like a neglected bow. So as a result, when they go to war, they fall by the sword. Okay, those are the three comparisons that he makes here in Hosea to the situation that they're in. It's interesting that you do this. One of the things I think you really see, go to the New Testament and you read Paul, or you read Peter, you read John. They just kind of come right out, and they're very, very doctrinal. It's always real interesting. When you have books that tell Bible stories, they always tell usually stories from the Old Testament or the Gospels. They don't tell a lot of stories about Paul. You know why? Because Paul's doctrinal. Paul doesn't tell stories. And does Paul use some metaphors? Sure he does. But the Old Testament is replete with metaphors because it was a very picturesque language. In fact, the very Hebrew language itself was built off a set of pictures. They all stood for different things at one time. Okay? And so it's very picturesque when you have these metaphors. So we'll put it into chapter 8. And in chapter 8, he is going to go through and he's going to look at things that Israel has attempted to try to solve their problems, and they've all ended in failure. The first one we're going to see is going to be that they set up princes and kings. Second one, 5 through 8, we're going to see, and these two really go together with the multiplied altar, but we're going to see religion and sacrifices, and both of those are a part of the multiplied altar. So they've tried to multiply altars or their religion. So we put it in verse 1. Put your trumpet to the lips, like an eagle that comes against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Transgressed my covenant means that they broke it. It means that the covenant was a legal covenant, and that's the covenant he's talking about. It's the covenant of the law, the Mosaic covenant. They cry out to me, my God, we of Israel know you. See, you remember in the last chapter that it says, oh, you don't cry out from the heart when you wail on your bed because you don't have grain and you don't have wine. So he's saying here, they do cry out, my God, we have Israel, we know you. But Israel's rejected the good thing. The enemy who's going to pursue him, they have set up kings, but not by me. Now, eventually he's going to rehearse some of Israel's history as Hosea goes on at another time. But at this time, he's talking about the fact that they set up all these kings. Now, one of the things that's real interesting, and I don't know if you still have it, but I would encourage you, we're not going to go through it in detail right now, but if you look at, if you ever pull that chart out, okay, that we used early on in this study, one of the things that's interesting to do is to look at the reign of the kings of Judah compared with the reign of the kings of Israel. Generally, you have longer rules in Judah than you have up north. The other thing you have going on in the south is everybody, right up until the time that they're taken away to Babylon, everybody that's ruling on the throne in Jerusalem is from what family? They're all from the family of David. They're all part of the Davidic line because that's what God had promised them. In the north, the first king of the north is Jeroboam. Not of the Davidic line. He's an Ephraimite. Okay. God, however, did establish him. But you have all kinds of intrigue going on in the north. If you've ever read through 1 and 2 Kings, you've got people that rise up, and you've got a brother that takes these people out, or you have a servant that rises up and kills these people, or you have somebody else that comes in, and you have the changing of families. The kings in the north are not all part of one family. So they set up a king like this. Somebody else comes along and goes, I don't like you. Yeah, I don't like the way you did. So they take them out. It takes out the whole family, and they're replaced with a different family that rules. And then somebody else rises up against them and kills them off, and another family rules. And as a result, they have in the north families and kings ruling that God never authorized. Did God authorize Jeroboam as king? Yes, he did. He told him, I will set you up as king. I will be with you. But that family eventually is deposed, largely because they were disobedient, but they were deposed, and another family replaces them. And this is the nature of the north. They end up having kings that God has never given authority to. How did God appoint kings in the south originally? I think eventually they just started doing it out of habit. But he sent up a prophet that anointed the king. You got that same kind of thing going on in the north, but they're not God's prophets. They're false prophets. So it goes on. As they've set up these princes, verse 4, they have set up, it says, they have set up kings, but not by me. They have anointed princes, but I didn't know it. With their silver and gold, they've made idols for themselves, that they may be cut off. Make sure I keep my bearings. Verse 5. He has rejected your calves, Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. So the first part of this is they've set up kings. Okay? They've set up kings. God hasn't authorized it. Secondly, now we come in here that he's burning against their idols, their religion. They set up a whole different religion that rivals it in the south. The religion of the calf initially. Which, as we said last week, what did Aaron say to the people of Israel when Moses was up on the mountain? This is your God that brought you out of Israel. This calf here, this golden calf. This brought you out of Israel. So you can see how part of this calf and this worship of the calf, how it comes up again under Jeroboam. This is your God. You don't need to go to Jerusalem. And so when they end up worshiping the calf, he says, my anger burns again them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? Verse 6, for from Israel is even this. A craftsman made it, so it is not God. You could go over to the book of Isaiah and you could read those wonderful chapters on the folly of idolatry over there where he says, you know, a person's got a chunk of wood. And he takes some of the wood and he cuts it up. And he makes fire with it to cook something for himself or to warm himself. He takes some of it and he makes something functional, like a chair or something to sit on. And he's got some leftover wood, so what does he do? He makes a god out of it. Something that he's used to serve him, he turns it into a god. And if he's got a little extra money, he gives somebody some stuff to pound some metal over the top of it so it's a little bit more permanent. But he's got to carry it because it can't go anywhere on its own. What a great God that is. It can't talk. It can't hear him. It's something made by human hands. And so this wonderful statement here that he makes in this statement, and I lost my place, middle of verse 6, a craftsman made it, so it's not God. Surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces. And it was. Menahem, the king up there in Syria, they eventually are going to try to get Assyria to help them in a situation. And one of the things that they're going to do is as a gift or an offering to that king, this calf is going to go up there. They're going to lose this gold calf. At least one of them, they're going to lose to that king. For they sow the wind, they reap the whirlwind. The standing grain is no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield? Strangers would swallow it up. So he looks at this. Number one, they sow the wind. You'd be a fool to go out and try to sow your crops in the traditional way that they sowed by hand and sow it in the wind. See, today we've got planting machines and you can do all that. But when they used to have to stand there and you used to have to broadcast like that, you're trying to broadcast on your field, sowing in the wind was a foolish endeavor. Second of all, not only that, but then when they reap the whirlwind. So they're out there trying to take their harvest, and so you're bundling your stuff up, and you got to put everything in bundles so you can haul it in to thresh it out. Okay? Don't think of it today where you drive a corn picker or a, nobody uses corn pickers anymore, a combine or something like that through the field, and you harvest all this. Everything had to be swapped. Everybody had to send guys out with a sickle. They took it all, they bundled up, and then they carried those sheaves in, and it all had to be beaten out. Could you imagine what it's like to be out there and taking a sickle through the grain and you're trying to harvest it and the whirlwind comes along? Because all that stuff's laying down out there in the field. What would you get? You'd have stuff blowing all over the place out there. Not only that, but the standing grain has no heads. You go out there and you look at it, you got standing grain, but it hasn't had enough to produce a head on it. So there's no grain. And even if it did, it'd be strangers that are going to swallow it. So this is their punishment for what they've turned to. They've turned to these false gods, and yet these false gods can't give them prosperity. The very prosperity that they had was given to them by God, not by these false gods that they make for themselves. So he says in verse 8, Israel has swallowed up. They are now among the nations like a vessel in which no one takes delight. And I would say it's really interesting that that statement there is still a statement that is really true for the most part about the nation of Israel. You and I have a different perspective on the nation of Israel today. But most nations in the world today, if they had their way, they would just let everybody else roll right over the top of them. They can't stand it. They just think that they're a pain in the neck. They probably use different language than that, but they don't like them. Verse 9, for they have gone to Assyria like a wild donkey, all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. Now, what is the irony in that statement? What's the irony in that last statement in verse 9? Okay, let's put it in the context of the book. What was Hosea's wife? What was she? She was a prostitute. What does a prostitute do? They have lovers to get something. Now what is she doing? She herself is hiring lovers. So this would be like a prostitute having men come to her and then she paying them. Does that make sense? It's foolish. But that's how stupid they've been in the way they've acted. And so he says here, they're like a wild donkey all along. They've wandered off like a wild donkey. Verse 10, even though they hire among the nations, now I will gather them up. And they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. We're in Hosea 8. We're going to put into verse 11. Since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, and this is that where we get this statement there. They've multiplied altars. They've only become altars of sinning for him. In other words, the more he did this, the more he sinned. I wrote them 10,000. And they said, they've added precepts here of my law. I don't think he's specifically saying 10,000 precepts. He says, I've written them 10,000 things in my law. Now, as far as if you really wanted precepts or commandments, according to the Jewish leaders, it was about 650 commandments total in the law that the Jewish leaders, the rabbis and such, had discerned by the time of Christ. They determined, or actually before that, they determined there were 650 commandments in the law. And don't ask me exactly what they all are. I suppose if you maybe go through a Jewish Talmud or something, you could probably find them listed out or something for you. But he said, what do they need to multiply altars for? He says, I've given you 10,000 things. Not 10,000 altars, but 10,000 things in my law. What do you need all these multiplied altars for? And as for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and they eat it, but the Lord has taken no delight in them. This wasn't a new thing. If you remember back early in Israel's history, before they had a king, you had Eli, who was the high priest, and you had his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who, I told you this before, I kind of always read those things and I picture them as a pair of gangsters, a pair of thugs. people come up there as priests, and it's like, we won't take boiled meat. We'll only take roasted meat. And then they stick the thing in, and they pull the meat out, and all the people go, wait a second, you're not doing this according to the law. And they basically, as a priest, said, we're the priests. We will do whatever we want. You want us to offer sacrifices, then you're going to do it our way. And they only wanted the best meat, the best cuts of meat, because they knew they were going to eat it. So they ate sacrifices, and that's what he says. They eat the sacrifices. But using Hophni and Phinehas as an example, for them it's all about eating the meal. It's not really about their relationship to God. What did God do to Hophni and Phinehas? Kill them. Kill them because they were foolish enough to go with the children of Israel off to war when they weren't supposed to. They weren't supposed to go into war, and they were supposed to take the ark into war, and they did, and God allowed Israel to be defeated and allowed Hophni and Phinehas to be killed. And when word comes back to Eli, Eli's sitting by the door, leaning back on his chair, and he's a great big fat old man, really old, he's dim, he can't see very well. And what happens when he hears about his son's death and the ark being taken away? Falls over backwards, falls against the thing and breaks his neck. That's how heavy he was. He broke his neck falling backwards against the wall.
Wasn't that a direct, God say you love your son more than you love me?
It doesn't say that in there. In fact, he actually tried to get his sons to behave, but they wouldn't listen to him. They just said, his sons basically treated him as like, oh, you're an old nut. You're an old coot. They wouldn't listen to him. And then one of their wives, remember, has a child. What does she name his child? Ichabod, we have, but Ichabod. Glory is left. The glory, Kabod, the glory. The glory is left. Without glory. Because the ark was gone. So this is just, I'm just using this. That's not the situation here. I'm just using it because it's illustrative of the situation here in verse 12, where you can have people that are going through, or verse 13, where they're going through the process of offering sacrifices, but as a result, the Lord has taken no delight in them. In other words, you could go through all the Jewish ritual without God having any real interest in what you're doing, because you're not doing it with the proper attitude. You're not doing it from the heart. And he goes on, and he says at the end of verse 13, in his punishment, he says, they will return to Egypt. Now this is important for you to understand, that is, shall we say, a metaphorical statement. Because what he's saying is that they're going to go back into a state of captivity or slavery. And the reason we know that is, if you look over in chapter 9, he's going to clarify what he meant by this. Chapter 9, and I'm getting behind here. Oh, I went too far. If you go to chapter 9 and verse 3, that's all the further we need to go. It says, they will not remain in the Lord's land, so not going to stay there. But Ephraim will return to Assyria, or return to Egypt. And in Assyria, they will eat unclean food. So actually, he's telling you very plainly in verse 3, they're going to Egypt. Okay, well, Assyria. That's where they're going to eat unclean food. You see how he does that? Because Egypt was the place of bondage and slavery that they'd come out of. Saying going back to Egypt is to say you're going into slavery. But where he's really going to take them, verse 3 tells you of chapter 9, he's going to take them to Assyria. Now, this is why this is important. At this point, who are they going to for help? Who are they looking to for help? Who? Assyria. And they don't realize the very Assyrians that they're turning to for help have been going around conquering all these other peoples. Now, remember when they come down against Jerusalem, the Assyrians come against Jerusalem after they've conquered Israel. When they come against Jerusalem, and Sennacherib comes down there with his armies, and he sends a messenger in there, and that messenger stands before them, and he reads that long message going, you know who I am, and you know all these nations out there, and he goes through and he rehearses all these kings and all these peoples throughout there. And he says, have any of their gods been able to deliver them from my hand? Your God won't be able to either. It's just like slapping, it's just like pulling out the glove and slapping God in the face. So God remember, goes out and takes out 185,000 of his army in one night. This man then left to fight, and he goes back. But the reason I say that, see, that's what he's going to do here. They're turning to Assyria, and they don't realize, as we said a little while ago, they're on Assyria's list. Assyria's going, first we take out these people, check. Then we take out these people. Then we take out these people. We just haven't gone to Israel yet, but we're getting there. And that's exactly what they're going to do.
What's the significance again of Ephraim?
Ephraim is the tribe in which Ephraim was the tribe that Jeroboam was from, the first king of Israel, that led their led them away from Jerusalem by setting up calf worship instead of saying go there. So he's the one that he's the first king of Israel, although God set him in that position, and he's the one that set up the calves and led them away from the worship of God in Jerusalem.
Because they did that, they're not named in the future stuff.
Yes. Joseph mentioned instead of Ephraim. It's Joseph and Manasseh. Okay. What's the other one that's missing in that list over there, too? Remember the other one? It's Daniel. Dan. Tribe of Dan. And in their place is Levi. Levi was never mentioned in that regard. But Dan is left out in that because of judgment on the tribe of Dan in this. And so if you go back to verse 14 of chapter 8 to conclude this, he says, for Israel has forgotten his maker. Doesn't remember who made Israel. Doesn't remember who created this nation, who brought them about, who put them in the position that they were in. And as a result, they multiplied fortified cities. So they took, again, pride and confidence in earthly things that God could topple so quickly and so easily. What a contrast. Assyria could come in and run over all those fortified cities down there. Now, by comparison, was Jerusalem anything greater to stand against? Were they so much better fortified? No. It's that God himself stood against the army. So who in the world could go out and take out 185,000 soldiers? One man, one person, all alone. Peg and I were just reading that today about two of Jacob's sons that went in because their sister Dinah had been essentially raped by Shechem. And they go in after they've told all these guys, well, we won't let you marry our sister and we won't enter an agreement until all the men in your city get circumcised. So all the men get circumcised, and then their third day it says when all the men are really sore, two of the brothers go into the sword and they kill every man in the city. Well, that's every man in a city, and by city we're talking about something probably smaller than Royal City at that time and really compact. And, of course, everybody's in a state of condition where they're not able to fight really well. But there wasn't 185,000, maybe 100 men that they took out. I don't know. That brings us to, how are we doing here? Let me check my time. Okay. Come down here. Chapters 9 through 10, we have the statements about the wandering heifer. The wandering heifer, how that's the way God pictures them here. A wandering, backsliding heifer, that's the way he looks at Israel. In other words, kind of like as though she's a heifer that's in heat, and she's wandering around looking for a bull. And she's just running all over the place and just keeps getting herself into trouble. And I'm not going to go through every last statement in here. But if you look in, pick out a couple of these things that we started at the beginning, it says, do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nations, for you have played the harlot, forsaking your God. You have loved the harlot's earnings on every threshing floor. See, it's always looking at the grain and the stuff and where they carried on. Threshing floor and wine press, they will not feed them, and the new wine will fail them. In other words, again, going back to what we've been seeing in the previous chapters, the very thing that God prospered them. They attributed the prosperity to Baal. God now is taking that prosperity away from them. So now their crops aren't going to produce. They're not going to have new wine. And it says in verse 3, they will not remain in the Lord's land. Ephraim will return to Egypt. In Assyria they will eat unclean food. Now unclean food, when we talk about that, can you think of another context in which we have an issue of unclean food? Connected with an exile. Daniel. in Daniel chapter 1. The king wants those men to eat the food that he ate. But the food that he ate was unclean because probably, number one, some of it was probably food that God didn't authorize under the law. So they're probably eating some pork. Okay? Maybe they're eating shellfish. Just, you realize that? See, I could get on just fine with that because I do like clams, but my wife, who loves shrimp, and I do not like shrimp, she'd have a tough time there because you couldn't eat shrimp if you were an Israelite. Okay? The only thing you could eat was fish that had scales. So think of all the seafood that'd be out. Of course, I do like squid. You couldn't eat squid if it's an Israelite. But, so anyway. Okay. So you've got, just think of the things that they eat. So that's probably part of it. But the other thing that makes the food unclean is that a lot of that food most likely was being sacrificed to idols. So a lot of it's probably being taken and sacrificed to Nebuchadnezzar's god and then brought before them. Because in their mind, that sacrificing that food and then eating of that food conferred a special blessing on you. Gave you special ability, special power. Now the interesting thing is when Daniel does that, and Daniel's put in a situation where he has to eat that, I want to ask you a question about Daniel because it directly ties to this. Was Daniel a perfect and innocent and upstanding character all of his life? No. You read Daniel 9. Daniel recognizes he was involved in the sin of Israel. He realizes that he's culpable with the rest of his people. It is not just them. He's all involved in it. That's why he was in an exile. But he was one of the people that in the exile did exactly what God wanted them to do. Recognize what we've done brought us here. It's time to change. And that's why Daniel is one of the ones that stands up with four of his friends. Now, I think there were probably a lot more Hebrew young men other than Daniel and his three friends. There were probably more Hebrew men than Daniel and those guys that did this. Who's one of the other guys? Zedekiah was one of the kings. He spent those last years in prison over there in Babylon and eventually ate from the king's table. What does that tell you about that king if he's eating from the king's table the rest of his life? He's eating that kind of stuff that he's supposed to eat. It didn't bother him. But see, the unique thing about Daniel and his three friends was they recognized in the captivity, in their exile, that they were someplace because of what they've done, and they're not going to do those things anymore, and they're going to do it the way God wanted it done in the first place. Now, to put that in the context here, when you come to verse 3, it says they're going to eat unclean food in Assyria. In other words, they're going to be put in the same situation where the stuff that's going to be given them when they go up there, it's not acceptable. They're going to eat food that God hasn't authorized, and they're going to eat food very likely that's been sacrificed to false gods, the gods of the Assyrians. Verse 4, they will not pour out libations, and a libation was a liquid offering. We don't use that word libation much anymore, but it was like something liquid that you poured out. So they pour out libations of wine to the Lord. Peg and I were reading about one of those in Genesis today where Jacob builds an altar of stones and then he takes oil, and his offering on that is he doesn't burn anything, he pours oil on the altar. That's what he does. That's the offering that he brings. So they will not pour out libations of wine to the Lord. Their sacrifices will not please him. It will be like mourner's bread. All who eat of it will be defiled, for their bread will be for themselves, and I will not enter the house of, and it will not enter the house of the Lord. In other words, everything that they try to do, everything they try to do to gain these things back because of their rebellion, God's going to refuse it. In other words, if they're up there trying to do up there when they're in Assyria what they should have been doing when they were in Israel, it's all going to fail. In other words, it's real interesting. You go to Daniel, what did Daniel do? Daniel did exactly what Solomon said they were supposed to do over in the book of 1 Kings and over in the book of 2 Chronicles. He bowed himself down facing Jerusalem and prayed to God. That's what he was supposed to do. He wasn't supposed to go to the altars and try over in Babylon to offer sacrifices to see if he could gain God's favor back. God didn't ask him to do that. There was only one place they were supposed to sacrifice. Daniel didn't have an option. He couldn't do that anymore. And so he goes on there in verse 5, what will you do on the day of the appointed festival, on the day of the feast of the Lord? I mean, what are you going to do on those feasts? You can't keep them because you can't go to the temple anymore. And behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Weeds will take over their treasures of silver, and thorns will be in their tents. In other words, again, as he's looking at Egypt and what he's doing, he's using Egypt again as a metaphor for their going back under a time of slavery and the treatment that they had. In other words, the treatment up in Assyria, it wasn't going to be that they were just being deported to Assyria. They're being taken to Assyria and they're being put to work, just like they've been put to work in Egypt. And then everything that they've left behind, the weeds grow up and take it over. Let's see if we can... let's go down to verse 10. It says, and I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. This is talking about when he first brings them out of Egypt. They were like grapes in the wilderness. I saw their forefathers as the earliest fruit of the fig tree. In other words, at first, when I was first dealing with them, there was a delight in dealing with the forefathers. They were interested. Things were going good. But they came to Baal Peor. What happened at Baal Peor? We're in verse 10 of chapter 9. What happened at Baal Peor? Baal Peor is the event in which Balak, the king, king of, is it the Ammonites? I believe it is. I might be wrong on exactly who the king is. But he sees them and he's terrified of these, and so he hires Balaam as a prophet of God, prophet of Jehovah, interestingly enough, but not an Israelite, to prophesy against them. And every time Balaam doesn't want to do it, but they implore him and implore him and implore him, and finally they bait him with enough money that he agrees to go. But he says, I can only say what God puts in my mouth. And every time Balaam opens his mouth, he blesses Israel till it drives Balak nuts. Then Balaam gives counsel to Balak, and he says, I can't curse him. I can only say what God put in my mouth. So you know what you do? You get God to punish them by you getting them to curse themselves. How do you do that? You get them to do something that God will punish them for. And one of the things that God will punish them for is if they sacrifice to false gods. Now, how do you get them to sacrifice to false gods? You get them to intermarry. So you send your best-looking women, this is Tim's take on it, but this is what goes on. You send your best-looking young single gals up there, and you have them walk around so that their young single guys are looking at those going, man, they're a lot better looking than our girls over here. Our girls don't dress like that. And then they'll join them, and those girls, as they marry, as they spend time with them, will prevail upon them to engage in the worship and sacrifice their idols. Once that happens, God will judge them, and we won't have to worry about it. And that's exactly what they did. And you had an incredible devastation to the people of Israel because of carrying on like this. By the way, interesting parallel and a good warning for us that you teach your kids not to compromise in this way. Nothing good comes out of compromise like this. It doesn't work. There was an example there in the Old Testament. It still, interestingly enough, still carries over with where we're at today. So he says, and after result at the end of verse 10, they became detestable as that which they loved, as detestable as that thing. And as for Ephraim, their glory will fly away like a bird, and their glory, remember, there is like their pride. It's all their prosperity and everything. Then he says in verse, then at the end of verse 11, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. So they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them until not a man is left. Yet woe to them indeed when I depart from them. One of the signs of prosperity under the law in the book of Deuteronomy were healthy children and the ability to have children. Now, he's saying, I'm going to take all that away. You're not going to have kids. You're going to lose them all. And I don't know if you understand this, but the idea of healthy children that live That's also a real big deal. We were talking early on in our study tonight about the relationship of mortality. And checking this out, you know, one of the reasons that at the time the Old Testament was written that the age, the average lifespan of a human being is only 30 years. Which we call 30 years. Back at the Old Testament time. At the time of Christ, it was 30 years. It was actually a little bit less even when you go back here to this time of the Old Testament. You know what skewed that so much? Infant mortality. Most children never made it past a year old. Most children died before they even reached a year. Every year that you progress, your ability to live further up, I mean, obviously you've lived longer, but every year that you progress, your chances of living even further are, it's, if you look at mortality charts, in the way, it's still that way today. If you're a grown man and you live to be 30, your chance of making it to 40 have multiplied over a person that's the age of 20. Person that makes it to 40, his thing increases even more over a person that's only at the age of 30. A person at the age of 30, his chances of making 50 are less than the person at the age of 40. In other words, the further out you go, the chances of life's of longevity increases. Well, their longevity was what cut. Not only that, but this is also going to be important down the road here in Hosea. Before the 20th century, this was a shocker. I didn't realize this. But before the 20th century, do you realize that approximately 30 to 40% of all women died giving birth? You and I don't appreciate when Paul talks about women over in 1 Timothy 2 being saved in childbirth, we go, okay. But we're living in the 20th century where we kind of know there's a lot of things we know that we can do that help women to be healthier, and we understand things and complications of going with childbirth. Before some of these things, close to 30% of all women died in childbirth at some time. That's a scary statistic. But that, of course, again, most women give birth to children young, which means that, again, that skews the whole mortality rate. And that's going to come in again here late, and we're not going to get to it tonight, but it's going to come in here before we're at the end of the book of Hosea. So maybe kind of log those facts in your mind and remember them, because he's going to make some statements that because of the way we do not understand infant mortality, we do not understand birth mortality, we have some problems. And so he says here, in this context, we're in chapter 9, verse 12, though they bring up their children, I'll grieve them until not a man is left, yet woe to them indeed when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I have seen, is planted in a pleasant meadow like Tyre. Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. In other words, the very thing that they're doing, the very way that they're carrying on, is going to end up in the deaths and the slaughter of their children. I mean, he's later on going to talk about something that's mentioned numerous times in the Old Testament, that some of these people were so horrible that when they went in, they weren't like the two sons of Jacob that killed every man in the city of their Shechem. They went in and they took all the children and they picked them up by the foot, threw the children on the ground and killed them like that. And the women that were pregnant, they took knives and split their bellies open. That's how violent they were. And he's going to talk about that later on here. But that's the kind of thing he's talking about when he says that Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. He thinks that he's promoting himself. He thinks he's trying to celebrate his prosperity. He thinks he's trying to protect himself. But in the very process, the very children he has are just being brought out to be slaughtered. It's not going to work. This is what's going to happen. And so he says, verse 14, last one we're going to look at here then. Give them, O Lord, what will you give? You'll give them a miscarrying womb, and you'll give them dry breasts. In other words, you're not going to have children. He lays that down in the following verses. He kind of continues more with that. We're going to pick up, that's the middle of a section. Chapters 9 and 10 come in a section, but we're not going to finish chapter 10 tonight. We've been at an hour here, so we better stop. But again, if you can kind of remember the overall context, what's happening is God's picturing this conflict between himself and Israel. He's looking at Israel as being an unfaithful wife, and now he's talking about his judgments. And as we looked at tonight, he was picturing some of the foolish things that Israel had done to try to protect themselves and how it didn't work. And how he compared them to some different things just kept getting them into trouble. They just kept getting themselves into trouble. They thought they got a solution. We got a solution to that problem. Didn't work. Got a solution to that problem. Didn't work. Their solution oftentimes was, we'll run to other nations. Don't run to God. Doesn't work. We'll multiply altars. Doesn't work. We'll make more idols. Doesn't work. We'll sacrifice even more. Doesn't work. What God wanted them to do was to turn around and come back to Him. Which is dumb. Think about that. If you've got a husband and wife, and you've got a wife that runs off unfaithful, engages in an adulterous prostitution type lifestyle like Gomer is doing here. She could do all kinds of things. She could send money home to her husband. She could give him gifts. She could butter him up. She could take him out to dinner. She could do all kinds of nice things. Is that what he wants? No. He wants her to change. He wants her to come back to him and be loyal to him. That's what he wants. He doesn't want any of this other stuff. That other stuff's all silly. It's not going to accomplish anything. And that's exactly where Israel is at. Let's close with a word of prayer, and then we'll move on into our business meeting. Our Father, we are indeed thankful for the prophecies of Hosea, the violence sometimes, and the metaphors that are used to describe what you are doing with these people. Sometimes may seem a little bit much for us. They don't always appealing to our palate, but we realize that they're necessary because they are a reminder to us that though you are a God that is big or broad or great in loving kindness, and though you are a God of all grace, and that you are a God of love, you are also a God who is absolutely righteous. And in your righteousness and in your holiness, there are certain demands that you have for those that would be yours. And there are things that you will not tolerate. There are things that you will deal with, not only those people, but you will deal even with us. Because you desire something more. You desire a certain loyalty. And we are thankful that you are long-suffering, that just as with the people of Israel through Hosea, you gave them time and you gave them revelation again and again. Get them to turn, that you also then are long-suffering with us. And you give us the opportunity as believers to change the way we think, to change the way we approach the various circumstances that we get ourselves involved in. And we're thankful then that we can know that about you. And even with Israel, that we didn't see it tonight, that even though you bring them under judgment, you will one day bring them back to yourself, and we realize that ultimately that is because you are a God that is gracious in the things that you do and faithful to your promises. And we're thankful that that is true for us as well. Thankful for this time as we conduct business. We ask that we would not do it strictly in a business-like fashion, but also in a fashion that would be glorifying to you, would reflect what you desire for us as a church and what you've revealed in your word. And we would thank you for the privilege of doing so then. Amen.